Monster Man, Episode 159, Bat, comma, Fire, to Be, comma, Giant. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are going to be continuing our journey through the B chapter, literally in this case, of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. Before we do that, though, a quick reminder, because I am away for much of the week of the 25th, I'm recording several of these episodes in advance. And what that means, I'm away at the time that I would be normally recording them. So what that means is that if you have sent me a message, I may not yet have had time to reply to it. So thanks for your patience. Also, if this episode sounds a little funny, I hope it won't, but if it does, I'm just experimenting with some different recording setups, not to get too inside baseball, but just in terms of like microphone placement and things like that. So hopefully it should sound a little clearer actually, but we'll see how it goes. Okay, in today's episode, we got three monsters, and three because I think I don't necessarily know that I have a lot to say about them. The first up is the Bat, comma, Fire. Now, this is not in the previous entry, the Bat, which did include the Mobat, which isn't real. But I guess the idea is that the Fire Bat is not, per se, a bat. It just looks a bit like a bat. It's an extraplanar creature. They're from, as you might expect, the elemental plane of fire, and they look pretty cool, all kind of bat-like, but wreathed in flame. This kind of goes back to the point that I made about the Azir, which is that if you were to associate bats with an elemental plane, I don't know that it would necessarily be the elemental plane of fire, and that makes these guys a lot of fun. Obviously, it's not just sticking gonzo elemental powers on things, but I do like kind of surprising examples of this, right? Just, it's just not what you would necessarily expect, and therefore I think it works pretty well. You can imagine these little guys flapping around in volcanoes, and one thing that it says is because they just kind of fly around on the elemental plane of fire, sometimes a wizard will be summoning a fire elemental, and a couple of fire bats will just slip through the opening, as they do. And then it says, quote, "Woe to the conjurer," close quotes. That's pretty cool, and again, sort of makes sense. You know, let's say you're going to fight a wizard who's been summoning fire elementals. The fire elementals might be under the wizard's direct control, but they also might just have fire bats infesting their lair because, you know, they're just kind of they're vermin, you know? I think that's fun. And they also do a quite bat-like thing where they cling onto you and get at you with their vampire mouths, but also, because they're fire bats, this lights you on fire. They're not trying to kill you by lighting you on fire, they're just on fire, so when they touch things, they catch on fire, you know, it makes sense. And there's a discussion of how the bats will behave, because they're not particularly aggressive. They're not going to stand around and fight and get slaughtered. Now, I don't know what the state of morale rules in this game is like at this point. There's not much discussion of morale in the Monster Manual, but I think it's nice to see, you know, hey, these are animals. And sometimes I feel like that gets forgotten in some games, like, oh, clearly you're going to get to fight this bear to the death. Yeah, the reason the bear's fighting you to the death is that the bear thinks it has quite a reasonable chance of winning. It might be wrong, but it doesn't know that. Anyway, fire bats. Yeah, I think they're not bad. And there's some good description of what encounters might be like, about the kinds of places that you might find fire bats on the prime material plane. So fire bats aren't going to be the main focus of a scenario ever, but I think that they are a fun piece of, you know, dungeon-filling monster that you might not otherwise think of. So, yeah, fire bats. I'm going to include some next time I have a fiery landscape in a D&D game, which would have to be the next time I run a D&D game. I don't think I'm going to put them in my post-apocalyptic game, which I have done for some of the monsters from this show, including the yellow musk creeper. Next up, we have the bear, comma, northern, parentheses, polar bear. That's Ursus Maritimus, the white devil. I was astonished to realize that the polar bear was not in the bear section of the Monster Manual, which contains the black bear, the brown bear, and the cave bear, but no bear, comma, northern, parentheses, polar bear. It seems like an oversight. Stats-wise, I am aware that the polar bear is the largest and considered the most dangerous bear species. It is significantly tougher than the brown bear, which I'm not so sure about. I mean, it's tougher than the cave bear, which I had always assumed was to be the pinnacle of bear fighting power, but what do I know? Polar bears are great. I mean, they're fine. They're just another kind of bear. But bears are a great example of a monster that people like, right? They're scary because you wouldn't want to get mauled by a bear, but everybody loves bears. They're adorable. Even the big scary ones are adorable because they constantly do kind of goofy, relatable things. You can visualize them sort of playing and being friendly. And they're also good accessories for certain other types of monsters. So if you're exploring the frozen north and you come across the carcass of a polar bear, you have to think, uh-oh, you know, polar bears don't have any natural predators. What could have done this? If you're visiting the hall of a barbarian queen and, you know, as she sits on her, and as she sits on her massive throne of, I don't know, walrus bones, and there she is sitting on her massive throne made out of whale bones, and, you know, crouched at her feet is her pet polar bear. Well, you know, that tells you something about a character who has as a pet this symbol of power and aggression. So polar bears are great. I mean, there's nothing special about them. They're just bears. But bears are a surprisingly versatile creature to have in your game because some animals are very unlikely to come up as antagonists, right? Like herd animals are only going to appear in one or two narrative contexts. You encounter them all over the place, but they're not interesting. And that goes for creatures like the Rothay, which is just another type of herd animal. And some animals are only ever going to come up just in a fight context. Outside of trying to get away from one, you're probably not going to spend too much time interacting with a crocodile. Although, there probably are some fun ways that you could. But bears are just versatile, and they occupy some space in our imaginations already, so they're easy to imbue with meaning. Bears are great. Polar bears are bears, and therefore they're also great. Finally, we come to the bee, comma, giant. Now, this is a case where we've got several different types of bee here, which makes me think that what we're looking for is an adventure within a giant beehive, right? Hives make great dungeons. And hives do get infested with other species, which would be an interesting thing. Like, what if it weren't the bees that you were trying to fight, but that some other species had infested the giant beehive? What if normally the giant beehive wasn't a threat at all, but just a place where halfling beekeepers went in with their special beekeeping clothing and, you know, harvested delicious honey for export? And not just honey, but there's some information in here on royal jelly, which has medical and anti-aging applications, and is described here as being coveted by noble women for its beauty-preserving purposes, which would be sexist if that weren't actually true. Like, royal jelly was marketed as a beauty product, and it probably continues to be so, I don't know. But I definitely remember, is it Barbara Cartland, the romance novelist, swore by royal jelly. Anyway, giant bees are pretty cool because, again, you can visualize bees and their weird herky-jerky movements, and that scales up in a way that doesn't make them more threatening. Like, getting stung by a bee is intensely painful. Getting stung by a giant bee is just getting stabbed, which is not as frightening somehow. It's more frightening when it's flying around your ear than when it's within the comprehensible D&D setting of just being a monster that's coming at your face. One thing that is interesting to me is if you take a look at the illustrations for the wasp, comma, giant in the Monster Manual and the hornet, comma, giant in the Fiend Folio and the bee, comma, giant in the Monster Manual too, they're all very similar to each other. They all show a fella trying to ward off one of these giant flying pests with his shield. So that's just, I don't know, kind of a curious coincidence, I guess. Anyway, I think the bee, comma, giant really comes into its own when you are in a beehive. I don't know much about beehives. I know that wasp nests often kind of get attached to, like, you get a wasp nest on the side of your shed or whatever. I don't know if bees do that. I don't maybe know as much about bees as I ought. But you can almost imagine a hive of giant bees attaching itself to something else, to some ancient fortification, and kind of like growing into it so that some of the tunnels are now full of the cells of beehives. So I think there's two scenarios there, right? One where the beehive has grown into somewhere that you need to be. Like, we got to explore these ancient ruins, but unfortunately giant bees have nested in there. Or the halflings are upset because their highly profitable export honey and royal jelly business is being threatened by some parasite that's infesting the beehive. We could go in there and tell the bees not to fight us, but, you know, they're bees, so they wouldn't listen. Or indeed, or some, like, apothecary hires you to find out what's interrupting a source of royal jelly, and then you go to the halfling village, and the halflings are all in a dudgeon about the problem with their bees, and then you go inside, and you find out that the bees have been infested, or someone else is stealing the royal jelly, or whatever, but you still have to cope with all these bees clambering everywhere. That could be a lot of fun, I think. Yeah, beehive. I don't know that it's, I mean, I don't think it'd be the centerpiece of your campaign, but it's definitely a fun variation, and again, because we know what bees look like and we know what beehives look like and these all have meaning for us already, it's easy and fun to imagine the characters squelching their way down the waxy tunnels of this giant beehive with all the, like, larvae wriggling in the little cells. I don't really know anything about bees, but I figured this is one 20-minute YouTube video about bees away from being a pretty fully developed scenario. All right, that's about all the time that we have for today. In our next episode, we're going to stay in the world of bugs and talk a little bit about beetles before moving on to the behemoth. So join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.